Welcome to another episode of the Property Nomads podcast, Property FAQs. This is the third part of a series that might go on for four, five, six episodes of questions that Aaron and I get asked on a fairly regular basis. We just want to say that these questions are in no particular order. A massive thank you for the questions that get sent in. Rob at tpmpodcast.com is the easiest way to get your questions sent over, or of course contact us on the various social media channels as well. So in no particular order, let's crack on and get this started. Actually, just before I do that, just a reminder that at some point, all of these questions that we have been given, that we're answering, we will put into a book. We will put it into book format. The reason for that is we appreciate that some people are going to be better audio learners, some people are better visual learners, so they need to see something. Some people are going to be better, as we say, kinetic learners, so they're going to need to hold something or touch something whilst they're learning, i.e. a book. So watch out for that. We will get around to that in due course. And I have to correct myself on something I said in the last episode of Property FAQs. I think even by the end of that episode, I realised I was tutting and umming and ahhing a lot more than I should do, which I thought I diluted the quality of the episode itself. So my apologies for that. I'm just trying to keep up the high standards that we have here at the Property Nomads podcast. So in no particular order, we will start at the top. How can you have multiple streams of property investing? I would say very simply, but it's not always that simple. But yes, you can easily have multiple streams of property investing. I said in the last episode that if you're going to get involved in something in property, you should focus on it. And our mentor, Rob Moore, says the same thing. You build up one pillar, become focused on one pillar, build up that one pillar. And then once you have built up that pillar, you've outsourced that pillar's running nicely and smoothly in the background, you then go on to the next pillar, and then you build it up, and then rinse and repeat the process. That's what Rob said the last time, you know, we had a quick chinwag. So you can have multiple streams in property. Now, you can achieve that in multiple ways, ironically. So you could have a buy-to-let portfolio, then you could have some joint venture products, projects in the background. You could have a portfolio of HMOs and then have a SIP, a self-invested pension, because you can use that to purchase commercial property or lend out on various aspects of property as well. So that could be one strategy. You could be deal sourcing. You could be matching investors to finance and vice versa. That's what Aaron does quite a lot of the time as well, has access to people that want to invest, and then has access to clients that are after funds for various projects. So it's a case of matching them together. That's another way of having finance. You could have a podcast. You know, we started a podcast off to provide as much information as we could to you to help you get kickstarted in property. As a result of that, having written books, having, you know, sponsors for the podcast, that's just another way to generate revenue whilst you're out and about adding value. You can have training programs. You can have mentorship programs. You can write books. You can, if you want to, do property consultancy. There are many things that you can do to have multiple streams of property investing. You can run an estate agency, you can run a lettings agent. And that's not even touching upon the many strategies that you can have within property. You can have commercial conversions, lease option business, rent-to-rent serviced accommodation business, houses in multiple occupation, HMO business. You can have a buy-to-let portfolio. You could be a public speaker. You could talk about property and get paid for it as well. You could host a network. Many, many things. What I would say, and again, this is from our mentor as well, focus on one thing. When you get started, focus on one thing, build up that pillar. Once you have achieved that pillar, boom, move on to the next one. What are the running costs of a property? If you already own your own home, probably no different, I would imagine. I will caveat this answer, though, and say that we're going to answer this from a buy-to-let point of view. I'm fully aware that if you are running commercial properties and other bits and bobs, that costs might be a bit different. But from a buy-to-let point of view, running costs that you're going to have, you are going to have any refurbs or any maintenance that need to happen. If you are not self-managing, then you're going to have a management fee that will come out every month as well. You're going to have to calculate for void periods that might happen. Potentially when the property is empty, you are then going to be looking at various bills, council tax, water, gas and electric, you know, whatever's applicable. You know, utilities, basically, in general. The easiest way to combat that is to start a MO account, so monthly operating expenses, MOE. And if you put 10% of the rental income, gross or net, however you want to run your business, into this account, then when something does pop up, you've then got that level of finance there that you're not panicking, basically, too much. We hear this quite a lot where people are, they're renting properties, around a good time, but they are either taking out all their cash, putting it into their back pockets at the end of each month, which again, nothing wrong with that at all, or they reinvest in 100% of it, which again, great idea. But then when something pops up, like say the boiler stops working, for example, if you haven't got the insurance to cover it, then that's an expense. And if you haven't got the cash in the bank, then, you know, it leads to all sorts of issues. You start panicking for no reason. So I would say create a monthly operating expenses account. Put 10% of your gross rent into that account at the end of each month and just let that build up. Let that build up, have a comfortable float of whatever you'd like. And then when something does happen, you've already accounted for it as such, and you could dip into that account rather than panicking and worrying. Yes, that will reduce your initial cash flow by a little bit, but again, learn from, you know, mistakes that we've made in the past. I would recommend getting that MO account set up. By the way, running costs of property also include property insurance. You need to have your home insurance there as well. I don't think I've missed out anything. If I have, I apologise. But when it comes to generic buy-to-lets, they are going to be the cost of the property. So you've got your insurance, you've got mortgage, of course, you've got your mortgage if you've got a mortgage on it, of course. Management fee if you are getting a management agent to manage the property for you. Cash into your MO account as well as a reserve. And again, on buy-to-lets, the only times when you are going to be liable for the utilities, council tax, etc., is when the property is empty. But you can almost get away around that with your tenancy agreement. The most common thing that we have is a tenant decides to leave early for whatever reason, and it's explicitly written in our tenancy agreements that if they do that, that's fine, but they are still liable for the bills. And we haven't had an issue with utility companies because all they have to do is look at the AST, and it says it quite clearly in the AST. As I said at the start, I'm aware that if you're running a commercial property or you're running a HMO, other strategies are available, that your running costs are probably going to be slightly different for whatever reason, due to business rates and whatnot. So that answers that from a buy-to-let point of view. How do you source good tradespeople? That comes down to research. That comes down to, I say taking the risk. I don't mean that in a very derogatory way. I think that whenever we want to work with someone new, there is a slight risk there if you don't really know each other that well. So that's what I mean by that. So, you know, take the risk and work with people. You can find, we say good tradespeople, recommendations, jump on social media, who's recommending who. Do you have estate agents that can recommend, you know, a carpenter, a sparky, etc., etc.? Maybe lettings agents are going to be able to recommend those sorts of tradespeople as well. most estate and letters agents are going to have their trusted team in-house anyway. So if you need an electrician to do a certificate, chances are speak it to your lettings agent. If you've got one, they'll be able to refer the work to their people. And of course, lettings agents want to work with reliable people, and estate agents, etc., want to work with reliable people anyway, because if the workmen are doing a good job, they're going to keep getting more work. Everyone's happy. You get what you want. The workman gets what they want. A lettings agent gets to facilitate business as well. And, you know, some let agents will cream a bit off the top as well. Happy days for them if they do. If you're not going via estate agents or lettings agents, again, you can check on social media. The internet's wonderful nowadays. You know, check a trader or trust a trader, whatever one it is. Trustpilot, numerous websites that you can check out as well. Always view the work that they've done within reason if you can. I appreciate pandemic has made that a bit harder, but any good work person is going to be proud of their work as well. One tip I've learned over the years is a bit askew with is always have a look at the quality of their van. If the van's in a good condition, clean condition, the chances are that their work is going to reflect their van. Now, this is a generic rule. If the van's scruffy, it's got a broken windscreen or, you know, broken mirror or something, chances are that tradesperson probably doesn't give a toss. And that might mean that the work might be a bit shady. So always check out the quality of their van and if it's in a clean and tidy state. General rule of thumb, but don't hold me to that. What do I need to do to successfully let a property, certificates, etc.? I'll try and keep this as evergreen as possible for the fact that it'd be great to have the podcast as an evergreen podcast. But this is always chopping and changing. At the moment, and again, I'm going to do this on a buy-to-let point of view. What I'm aware of that you need is you need a valid energy performance certificate. So again, at the time of recording, it should be an E or above, A being the very best, G being the very worst. There are going to be circumstances where you might have an F or a G and you might still be able to rent it. Again, you need to work on that. You know, for example, if the building is listed, for example, the EPC rating might be very, very poor, but you might still be able to let it because it's a listed building. Other things you need an electrical safety certificate nowadays, so you want to make sure that your properties have one of them, a five-year periodical. Again, get an electrician, sorry, to get that sorted for you. You also need an up-to-date consumer unit, etc., etc. But the Sparky can go through that with you. Refer back to the last question. You can source a good tradesperson yourself online, or again, speak to your local estate agent, lettings agent. They should be able to facilitate that for you if necessary. A gas safety certificate if your property has a mains gas connection, they've got a boiler an old back boiler or whatever it might be. You need a gas safety. They need to be done once a year as well. You also need smoke alarms in your properties as well, one on each floor. They don't necessarily have to be hardwired, to the best of my knowledge. If you've got a 10-year lithium battery, they will do in certain circumstances. And also if you've got a fuel appliance like a boiler, or you might have a log burner or whatever it might be, you need a carbon monoxide alarm as per the regulations. You also need to have insurance. That is crucial. You definitely need to have insurance, so get that in place. When it comes to successfully letting a property, I'm not ALA registered, so I'm not on the Association of Residential Lettings Agents, but I am fully aware that there are various things that need to be followed. Right to rent checks as well need to be adhered to. When it comes to deposits, my understanding is that a deposit needs to be popped into a scheme, a government-backed scheme, but again, your lettings agents can do that for you. And as I've just said, and I'll repeat myself, I am not an I'm not a registered residential lettings agent, so I don't want to say a bunch of things if they don't turn out to be quite true. Check out the ALA website with what you need. But again, if you are having other people manage your properties for you, they should be able to have the qualifications that they need, and they should be able to take care of all of this for you. You might need other things like Legionnaires testing, right to rent checks, which we've just gone through. Make sure deposits goes into the right place. And there are limits on deposits and whatnot as well. Also, I would say quite flippantly, what do I need to do to successfully let a property? Make sure you've got a good property in a good area that you know is going to rent. And that's where you have to do your research at the start. So when you're buying, find out what areas are working, what's going like hotcakes, what do people want? Is it close to good schools, transport links? Are the fundamentals there? If you've got the fundamentals there, then chances are that you've done your own homework, and it means you're going to have a better chance of successfully letting that property in the first place. So I'm hoping it answers that question for you. Another question here, what team will I need? Flippantly, you only need the New York Jets. Don't support the New York Jets, please. American football, I love them, but they're a pain. But assuming you mean a power team, you will need, over the course of your property investing experience, you're going to need quite a few people in your power team. To get started, you need a solicitor. You're going to need a mortgage broker, more than likely an accountant, quite possibly a tax planner. You will need to be on good terms with various estate agents, lettings agents. You might go down the route of property sourcing. Therefore, you know, you need to befriend a property sourcer because they'll be an invaluable part of the team. Tradespeople as well. Again, you can do that in two ways. You could do that yourself, or you can do that through your estate agent, lettings agent, or property sourcer. I think in my book, Buy to Let, How to Get Started, I think there's a list of 14 key people that you'll need in your power team. So I'll refer you back to that book. A link will be in the show notes. They're the people that you will need. Broker, solicitor, estate agents, lettings agents, tradespeople, accountant, tax specialist as well. The one that I know that isn't in the book that you might need is a mentor. Find someone that's been there and done that before. Find someone that understands the challenges that you may or may not be having, especially if you're getting started. A good mentor is invaluable, priceless, pretty much. So add that to your team of people that you will need. Next question, what happens if something goes wrong? In fact, that's actually covered pretty much in episode 2. It seems that we have a lot of people that like to worry. I wouldn't worry too much. If something goes wrong, it goes wrong. I'll go back to Marcus Aurelius as I did in the previous FAQ episode. Anything that happens in life is objective. How you react is subjective. So if something goes wrong, deal with it. If a valuation comes in and it's lower than you thought, deal with it. Have the chat with the investor if you're using their finance. If it means you've got to leave a bit of extra cash in the deal, it is what it is. If something goes wrong, you know, if something happens in the refurb stage, you know, inquire, how did that go wrong? What happened? What can I learn for next time so it doesn't happen again? Yeah, we covered this in the previous episode. There are many things that can go wrong, but when something does go wrong, don't become an ostrich. And I say don't become an ostrich because they're known for apparently burying their head in the sand, even though there's never been a recorded case in history when an ostrich has actually buried their head in the sand. Go figure that one out. Point being, if something goes wrong, deal with it. Yeah, absolutely deal with it. It might not be the best conversation that you ever have with someone, but it's better to have that conversation, front up to it, than shy away from it. So that is what you should do if something goes wrong. What's the difference between freehold and leasehold? I'm guessing you probably, this has been sent in on the back of Aviva and Persimmons sorting out all their leasehold and freehold issues. Freehold effectively means that you own the land that your home is on. Leasehold means that you don't own the land that your property is on. That is a very layman's terms. I'd advise you Google it, or again, I'll refer back to Buy-to-Let How to Get Started. There's an in-depth explanation there. There's many advantages to both and disadvantages to both. If you are a freeholder, for example, if something goes pitong on your property, then you got to deal with it, and that cost is pretty much yours. If you're a leaseholder and something goes wrong, let's just say the roof blows off on most leaseholds, not every leasehold, but on most leaseholds, then it's probably going to be freeholder responsibility to deal with said issues. Extra cost to be aware of: if you are a leaseholder, the chances are that you're going to have to pay a service charge and ground rent. Again, that doesn't necessarily happen on every single leasehold. I'm being very generic here in my answer. But chances are that you're going to have to pay some form of rent, ground charge, service charge, management fee, etc. Whereas you don't have to do that if you own the freehold. Length of leasehold can vary as well. People love buying flats. There's nothing wrong with that. You just got to check the contracts. Make sure that you know what you're signing yourself up to. This would be my argument with the Persimmons and Aviva stuff. Again, I'm going to fence sit because I can see both sides. I understand if you're a house building company or your property company or whatever, that everyone's in it for business. You want to make as much money as possible. And sometimes that is a, you know, to the detriment of others. That is capitalism in general. That being said, that the people that have been on the wrong end of leasehold issues, I worry about their legal teams. I worry about their solicitors. The fact that these things haven't been brought up or mentioned to them. And that could be the fact that they weren't expecting it, or their legal team didn't point them out, which is concerning if that is the case. Or the fact that they haven't had the education to understand X, Y, and Z. So, you know, again, I'm going to sit on the fence here. I can see both sides. I'm not saying what's right or wrong. At the end of the day, we have to take responsibility of where we are in our lives. If we're not where we want to be, we have to look at ourselves and go, why am I not where I want to be? Not constantly be in this blame culture of, oh, this happened, well, I blame you, and this happened, and I blame A, B, and C, and, oh, X, Y, and Z didn't happen, blah, blah, blah. Another mentor of ours said a while ago, to Rob, you can either play a victim or you can be a victor. What one do you want to be? What one do you want to play? I love that advice. Play the victor. Play the victor. Do your homework. Do your understanding. And problem solved. I'm aware that I've tutted again, I think, too much in this episode as well. I do apologise for that. So there's some more questions there. There are some FAQ questions. Hopefully that all makes sense. With the freehold and leasehold, just going back to that briefly, do Google that for more information. And always, no matter what property you're building, what type of property you're building, always inquire as whether it's freehold or leasehold. If it's a leasehold, inquire to the length of the lease. And just ask your solicitor, your legal team, your legal representatives a bunch of questions as well. Because then it will stop a lot of things from happening in the future. Better to do your homework now and do your research now than have something bite you in the ass moving further on down the line. Hopefully that's useful. As always, we love reviews on the podcast. Head over to iTunes. A 5-star review would be wonderful. That just helps to get the Property Nomads podcast message out there. Helps to help more people to get started in property and to not make mistakes that we might have made over the years as well. We've got some great content coming up. Well, I appreciate that we're approaching episode 200, which is a great milestone as well. And it's thank you to your support, for you listening to the podcast, for you recommending the podcast, and that longevity that we're starting to build up as well. So a massive thank you to you. If you want any more questions answered, rob@tpmpodcast.com, please email in and we'll do our best to get them answered. Until next time, hasta luego.